You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 31st of May. And with 1 month to go until the latest emiratization target on the 1st of June, we spoke to Emiratis making a move to the private sector. And we also found out whether private companies are likely to meet the target. That was with recruitment expert John Fitzpatrick from Emiratalent. Meanwhile, a Dubai hospital has started delivering medicines with drones. So is this a scalable plan? We found out with the CEO of Faqih University Hospital. Plus, we discussed the fast-developing Chinese space program and why it's unnerving the US with Dr. Christoph Beischel from the London Institute of Space Policy and Law. And with only 1 month until the unemployment insurance deadline, we'll remind you who can apply and how. Plus, with 6 months to go until COP28, every ministry, government entity and private company are figuring out how to improve their green credentials. So the announcements are coming thick and fast. Now, one organisation leading the charge is the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi. As certain habitats of the Emirate are getting an extra layer of protection. We heard what that means for wildlife with Ashraf Al-Sibahi, who's in charge of marine protected areas for the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi. And Andrew Hosey brought us up to date with all the latest sports headlines, including all the action from the French Open. Let's turn our attention now to a big local story. It's one that's been rumbling on for a while and it is set to continue because we are coming up to another deadline for the emiratization target. There's just 1 month to go until private firms with more than 50 employees must ensure that 3% of their workforce are Emiratis. Now, you might remember we talked about this back at the beginning of the year. That was the first deadline. You had to have 2% then. And then we all thought that we had a year to go. I say we, CEOs, thought they had a year to go. But actually, the Ministry of Human Resources and Emiratization brought forward the next deadline to the 1st of July. So you now need to have 3% by the 1st of July, and then 4% by the end of the year, and then 5% again by next July, and then 6%. And it goes all the way up to 10% by the start of 2027. Now, if firms do not fulfil their obligations, they can be fined up to 42,000 dirhams for each Emirati that's not employed. And that happens every year. Now, it does seem to be working. This policy does indeed seem to be making private companies hire more Emiratis because the latest figures, and these are from really recently, they're from the 17th of May, show close to 68,000 Emiratis are now employed in the country's private sector, with the workforce increasing by more than a third so far this year. Those are official figures, and they show that more than 17,000 nationals have joined private companies this year. That is a very decent rise. Okay, so speaking on the agenda, His Excellency Ghanem Al-Mazrui. Now, he's Secretary General of the Emirati Talent Competitiveness Council. It's also known as NAF, as they're responsible for trying to encourage more nationals to get into the private sector. He told us that the emiratization program has largely been a success.
There is a huge jump when it comes for the total UAE national, 50,000 plus nowadays in the private sector, an increase by 70%, where we see more than 70% of the company that require to hire UAE national with the 2% compliance, 70% companies has already compliant, 10% partially compliant, and there is around less than 20%, between 18 to 19%, have not comply to the regulation.
Okay, so what is it like for an Emirati to join a private company? Because obviously what you've just heard there is the stick, effectively. You've got a carrot and stick vibe. There's a stick that's being applied to the private sector. But in turn, there's a carrot that's being offered to Emiratis to encourage them to work in the private sector. And it's really interesting to find out how that the sort of there's a mind shift going on within the national population. And in order to understand that, we wanted to speak to someone who's actually grown up within the community. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined now in the studio by Rafia Hussein. She's an Emirati who works in a bank here in the UAE. And she has very kindly joined me now in the studio to talk through the reasons behind her decision and ultimately how it feels now to be working in the private sector. Rafia, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you. Good morning. Firstly, it's a delight to be on the show this morning.
Oh, it's so good to have you join us. And thank you so much for taking the time out of your working day. Okay, so obviously, as an Emirati growing up in the UAE, what led you to work for a private company rather than the public sector? Because it's a decision you actually made quite a few years ago, isn't it?
Yes, I started working in the private sector since 2014. So we are talking about approximately 9 years. My area of expertise is mostly in HR, where most of my experience was until I shifted to marketing recently. And it's been very different take, you know?
Really? So, yes, so it was exactly. Different?
Yes. So working in the private sector definitely comes with its benefit of hours flexibility, bonus, life insurance, health insurance, and a different side of the industry, different cultures, backgrounds, you know?
Yeah, because you're working with...
Multicultural environment.
Well, this is exactly... Yeah, so in the public sector, nearly everyone you're working with in government positions is from the same background as you. Did you really notice that there was quite a difference when you started working at the bank? Because it was, as you say, very multicultural.
Definitely. It was at the beginning shocking and it was something different.
Yeah.
But at the end, when you will get to know the person, you will be like, start sharing your interest with them, give and take, let's say. And yes, we end up clicking.
Yes, you get a sense that there's that sort of period of growth. I mean, exactly. When you first went into the industry, were you literally a fresh graduate straight out of uni?
So yes, I was a fresh graduate and training was really a requirement back then.
And so when you went into that company, was it part of a recruitment drive for Emiratis or was it just part of a normal recruitment drive?
It was a normal.
Fantastic.
Back then, yes.
And so obviously your parents, when you're in your early 20s, your parents are always very much involved in how, you know, in you know, what your choices are in any country. Were they surprised when you chose to work for the private sector rather than the public sector?
Yes, definitely. The first thing my father told me back then, I remember, he was like, you will be working till 4, 5 p.m. I would rather you work till 2 p.m. I was like, yes, likewise, but I think like they really offer things that I like, for example, facilities or like benefits, let's say, that government sector won't be able to provide, actually. So I told him, for example, the bonus. I'd be happy with my bonus.
That is so interesting because I'd always thought that the public sector gave you more money.
Yes, more.
But you preferred the private sector because of the opportunities it gave
you. It's not only like that. It's like I graduated from an English school. So the environment and, for example, my surroundings as well. It was also, there was an impact from this side as well.
So you wanted to work in a more multicultural environment.
Yes.
That's interesting because that gives you a sense that it's a real mindset situation, that actually in many ways it's how you're schooled more than the attitudes of your family, interestingly. How about your friends? What did your friends think about it?
My friends, actually, they miss me.
Is that because you have less free time ultimately because you
exactly.
are working?
But now, like post-COVID, you know, we started having more flexible working hours, like in terms of working from home. Working, we can like meet with our friends in a coffee shop to work. We still can deliver.
Of course, yeah. We've all learnt that you don't need to be in the office full time in order to hit your productivity targets. And do you have any regrets when you see all your mates, you know, finishing work at 2 and going to coffee shops or relaxing or spending having more free time? Do you have any regrets about the choice that you made?
No regrets. Definitely, I enjoy working. We have flexible working hours, which definitely helps with the productivity, you know?
Yes.
And having a social life as well. So
there's balance.
No issues from my end.
How about what you found that was unexpected in the workplace. Was there anything that surprised you about the private sector?
Yes, the different mindset and backgrounds was definitely a shocker for me. Being with the really close to different backgrounds, let's say different beliefs.
I suppose attitudes are different, aren't they?
Yes, an attitude is a must.
Yes.
An attitude is a must.
Okay, so this is very interesting. Do you think more Emiratis are starting to work in the private sector within your community? Is it a sort of topic of conversation more than, for example, it used to be?
Yes, because I always tell them, I believe there is so much room for growth in this sector, but there is a lot of hard work and disciplines involved. Like Emiratis, basically, they always want to feel home.
Yes.
If any private sector try to absorb them, you know, and just try to understand the culture and the background they come from, it will be really easy to let them adjust to the workplace and accept the fact to be part of the family.
That's really fantastic advice, because actually in the next few minutes, we are going to be joined by a recruitment expert. And I think that this is one of the touchstones that many of the private companies are going to need to access. They're going to need to find out what it is that is going to encourage Emiratis into the private sector. It's been a great pleasure having you on the radio, Rafia. Thank you so much for joining us and sort of explaining your mindset and why you personally, basically it's just your personal story, but we're going to use you as a lens into the Emirati world. So thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio.
Thank you, Georgia.
It's been a great pleasure. Hello there, welcome back to the show, discussing Emiratization on the programme today, because we're fast approaching another deadline. Just 1 month to go until private firms with more than 50 employees must ensure that 3% of their workforce are Emiratis. Really interesting there to hear from Rafia Hussain, who's an Emirati working in a bank here in the UAE. She's been in the private sector for nine years, but it was really interesting hearing about how important workplace culture was to her and how that was a sort of mind shift for her. So how difficult is it proving now to private companies to get more Emiratis into the workplace? Let's find out with recruitment expert John Fitzpatrick. He is the managing director of Emiratalent. They are an award-winning Emiratization and staffing solutions recruitment company. John, good to have you on the line again. How are you?
Hello, Georgia. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back on the show, and thank you very much for inviting Emiratalent to comment on this very hot topic.
Yeah, good to have you with us. Is it getting harder? I said on the Business Breakfast this morning, and everyone teased me. Have the private companies picked all the low hanging Emirati fruit off the tree, and now is it getting difficult to find more Emiratis who are happy to work in the private workplace?
I think the short answer, Georgia, is that yes, the low-hanging fruit has been, as you would expect, picked. And, you know, we're finding ourselves in a situation now where it is getting increasingly difficult to attract and connect with, good Emirati talent. So, obviously the team here at Emiratalent are particularly busy at the moment assisting people with those challenges. So, yeah, the low fruit's being picked, and people are kind of having to up their game or philosophy in terms of how they attract these individuals.
You'll have a real finger on the pulse for the private sector on this question mark. You know, are people finding it? Are people getting nervous about meeting the deadlines ultimately?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think, I still believe that there are a number of companies that are, get caught napping and not planning for this properly. There's a, vast majority of organizations are being particularly responsible and focused on achieving their challenges. It's a real concern for a lot of companies. And you mentioned earlier, the fines that are involved, obviously that's reported on biannually now, as you say. But from 2022, it's 6,000 per Emirati per year. And then going each year to 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, and 10,000 per Emirati. So those fines are going, are going to go or have gone from 72 all the way through to 120,000 per Emirati member of staff that you don't hire. So some massive focus on this. And I think, one of the key words is to make sure that organizations are planning and do understand that because they're fishing in a talent pool of perhaps 10 to 12% of the population, then they must realize that the process to hire and attract and everything else is going to be significantly longer.
What do nationals want? We just had a lovely chat with Rafia, who explained that there's a sort of different attitude in the workplace. There's a different workplace culture in the private sector to the public sector. And she felt that that might put people off. What are they looking for?
I think, you know, there's different mindsets amongst every group, every niche group, every nationality that we come in contact with. And I think that, you know, we are looking for individuals that want to consider their future careers as international employees. And when I say that, I mean that, you know, whilst the government companies are fantastic and they do offer great benefits, security and all those wonderful things. For me personally, I think it's super to have on the CV an Emirati, having worked for private sector companies, MNCs, multinational companies. And I think that's going to become even more important and prevalent in the hiring process as we move through the next, you know, 5, 10 plus years. And our country and our commercial culture diversifies further and broadens internationally speaking.
Really interesting there to catch up with you again, John. And no doubt you'll be on the radio quite a bit over the next few months, because we have got that deadline fast approaching. I think it's either the 30th of June or the 1st of July, but you get the gist. There's only about a month to go till that next 3% deadline. John Fitzpatrick there, the Managing Director of Emira Talent. They're an award-winning emiratization and staffing solutions recruitment company. I seem to have problems with the word staffing. I say starving. Staffing Solutions Recruitment Company. John's laughing at me. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Great to have you right here on the agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, drones are being used to deliver medicines in Dubai, and it's the first time it's ever happened in the wider Middle East. Now, at the moment, it's just a trial, but Faki University Hospital has succeeded in transporting urgent medicines directly to people's homes. Now, the idea behind it is to significantly reduce response times and, of course, therefore potentially save lives. Now, the trial is part of the ongoing Dubai program to enable drone transportation, which was launched by Sheikh Hamdan, the Crown Prince of Dubai, in 2021. So it's part of a sort of broader study. And I wanted to find out a bit more about it. So I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Fatih Mehmet Gul, who is Chief Executive of Faki University Hospital. He joins me on Teams. Thank you so much for joining me, Mr. Gul. Tell me, why use the drones? It's an unusual idea, but it sounds like it's working well.
Good morning, and thanks for having me in your program. We should understand one thing. The entire lifestyle after the COVID has changed, and people are looking for the services with the motto, anything, anytime, anywhere concept. And the same expectation is happening from all the industries. And it is our job actually to find the ways how we can adapt to these changes or required changes, what is expected from our patients and the people. So that's exactly what we're looking for. And from the hospital side, since the beginning of our operation and from our legacy from the Saudi operation, we have told to our community, we will be the benchmark hospital when it comes to the academic care, technology investment, and then the implementations, and then the healing environment. So that was perfectly working together with our strategy for the technology implementation. And when we have been asked, actually, if we can contribute and collaborate together with the parties for this kind of innovation in Dubai, we were very happy. And definitely, this is a work of last 2 years. I mean, we have been working hard together with lots of authorities, starting from Dubai Silicon Oasis, Dubai Future Museum, and then civil aviation and lots of other authorities. Then I'm glad that we have reached to that stage to test it and see the outcome, which actually helped us to learn even further, and I can see the future.
It's very, very cool, I have to say. It's one of those, back from the future ideas to actually see it working. Can you tell me a bit more about how the actual process work? So, you know, is the drone steered by someone, or is it automatic, or is it how far away can you deliver medicine, all the sort of machinery of the thing?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you. It is, easy to say, but difficult to, operate. At the end of the day, we're planning to deliver one of the most sensitive material, which has to be controlled and which has to be given to the person exactly. And from that point of view, we have created the policy and procedures together with the authorities, with the DHA, and then our own pharmacy teams. Based on these policies, we have a method, a different box for each kind of medication. So when the patient requests to have the medication delivered to home, definitely there are some regimens that we have to make earlier. And then we have already created some assembly point kind of things in DSO. So then people can collect the medication from these points, and there will be some extra elements, personalized collection points for some homes, which are mainly for the villa compounds that we have around us. So we have already created that map, and within our map, we have the landing points of those personalized clients, I can say. And we will be, offering this service based on that map distribution. So when the patient requests that one, there will be a connection through the WhatsApp that we have. We have a chatbot over there. Patient simply can go to this chatbot. And by the way, that's not the only delivery method that we have. We have the motorcycle delivery. This is the first option. Second option is the bot delivery. And we have a new bot. Actually, it is a tiny, cute robot. You can simply put the medication inside, and then it has 6 wheels. It can deliver to anywhere and everywhere in DSO. On top of that, now we have the drone. So it is up to the patient. Patient can simply select in which way the delivery could happen. And then based on their desire, we will simply put the medication into the delivery method box. Mm-hmm. Then kind of equipment, whatever we have, if it is drone or bot, they will go. But here, one thing is very important. Other than motorcycle, these are completely self-operated devices. So we do not interfere on anything. We just arrange the box, put the box into the machine, and just put the address. The rest is happening completely by this device itself, which makes me excited as a physician. And that's the feature.
Yeah, it really is. It sounds completely extraordinary. Amazing to hear there about the progress being made. Of course, at the moment, just a trial, but I'm sure set to be implemented more widely soon. Great to speak to you there. Thank you so much for your time. You've been listening to the voice of Fatih Mehmet Gul, who's chief executive of Fakih University Hospital. And with 6 months to go until the start of the UN's climate change talks here in the UAE, you sort of get a sense that everyone is prepping themselves. You've got every ministry, every government entity, loads of private companies all figuring out how to improve their green credentials and make sure that we know about them. For example, in the last few hours, 28 companies in the UAE's industrial sector have pledged to try to reduce carbon emissions and to adopt more sustainable ways of operating. These are big cheeses. Included are Emirates Steel Arcan, you've got Rack White Cement, Accor, Colis, Aegis and IFCO, among others. I have to admit, I just sort of picked out the names that I instantly recognised. Meanwhile, the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi have also come out with a new announcement that wildlife and natural habitats in the Emirate are getting an extra layer of protection. They've got a new policy. It'll cover things like areas such as Al Sadiat Marine National Park, Mangrove Marine National Park, plus you've got the Hubra Protected Area in Al Dhafra and the coral reefs of the Al Yasat Marine Protected Area, among others. They're going to be covered by this protected areas policy. And that means that any developments, you know, hotel, community developments or any projects in or near the areas will require environmental impact studies and a special license. Let's find out a little bit more about the aim of this policy. I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line by Ashraf Al-Sibahi. He is the section manager of the Marine Protected Areas for the Environment Agency, Abu Dhabi. Sir, thank you for joining me on Teams. Great to have you with us. Can you give me a little bit more of an outline of how this new policy will work?
Thank you, Georgia, and good morning to Dubai Eye and our listener. Highlighting our protected area policy that is being issued by the Environment Agency of Abu Dhabi this year is very appreciated from your channel. The protected area policy works as a framework for integrating the conservation of nature into the different plans of the government sectors and the semi-government and the private entities as well. Our approach is to ensure win-win scenarios when dealing with environmental, social, and economic development. And this is an important integration for the sustainability of the environment, which are also being commended by the announcement of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, UAE President, to declare 2023 the year of sustainability of the country.
It is very difficult when you're looking at a fast-developing emirate such as Abu Dhabi to balance that against, you know, preserving these very valuable environmental areas. We're talking about, you know, the mangrove fields, for example, which are so key to their carbon sinks, but they're also marine breeding grounds. And it's really difficult because, of course, everyone wants a beachside lifestyle, but you can't really build houses and protect mangroves at the same time.
It is really, yes, I agree it is difficult, but when you have the political will and the support, so everything will be easy. We aim to protect, and it's not only protection for the sake of protection, but it is for nature, for sustainable uses and sustainable benefits. So it will be hand in hand with the development. It will emphasize and support the development of the country and the lifestyle of people in United Arab Emirates.
And so why is it particularly important to protect the areas I've just mentioned? Things like the Al Sadiat Marine National Park, you've got the Mangrove Marine National Park. Is the Hubara a bird? Is that another protected area?
Yeah, it's a Hubara postured. It's a land protected area. A series of protected areas we have been announcing since 2001, starting with Marawah Marine Biosphere Reserve, a UNESCO site, to Al-Wathba Wetland Reserve, which is also a international green listed as protected areas. We have now 20 protected areas in a network. We call it Zayed Network Protected Areas. The policy comes after the Zayed Network of Protected Areas as a strategic and legislative element to increase the use of these areas and also to increase the areas. Internationally, the trend is to have 30% by 2030, what they call it 30 by 30 target. It's an international target for global organizations for each country to work to develop and establish protected areas to conserve at least 30% of their geographical areas for the important habitat ecosystems, like, as you said, mangrove habitats, coral reef habitats, sand dune habitats. All of these are important ecosystem, or what we call it, life support systems.
Does Abu Dhabi or does the UAE have some specific animals that are only native to this country that you've been working to protect and that these new policies will continue to protect?
Yes. The biggest example of our latest success is the Arabian oryx, which has been which is an endangered species, and have been supported to breed and freely roaming now in protected areas like the Oryx protected area in Abu Dhabi. This is a biggest mammal which was endangered in nature and now returned back, and the situation becomes better. Adding to this, we have at sea, we have dolphins and we have dugong. We consider Abu Dhabi as the second largest ecosystem to encompass and safeguard the second largest population in the world after Australia.
That is fascinating. I hadn't realised that the situation there with the dolphins and the dugong. I have to say, I have come across an oryx in the past. They're amazing animals. They've got much longer horns than you might expect. Great to hear from you there, sir. Thank you very much indeed for explaining more about that new policy to protect certain areas in Abu Dhabi. That was Ashraf Al-Sabahi. He is Section Manager for Marine Protected Areas for the Environment Agency for Abu Dhabi. Fantastic to have you join us here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8. Thank you so much for your time.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Now, you've probably seen in the newspapers that the Saudis are celebrating after the successful return to Earth of two of their astronauts. They've spent 8 days on the International Space Station. And in fact, Rayana Barnawi and Ali Al-Khani both made history. They were the first Saudi astronauts to go on a mission to the space station. And importantly, Miss Barnawi was also the first Arab woman to go into space. It was a real milestone there. But the kingdom is not the only nation celebrating, because the Chinese also yesterday sent their first civilian astronaut into orbit. It's another milestone in the country's incredibly ambitious space program, which is gathering pace. They recently saw the completion of their Chang'e space station back in November, and they've had astronauts on that orbiting space center for the last 6 months. But it's fair to say that the Chinese program and its speed has slightly unnerved the United States. There's a sort of a sense of competition between the two countries. They're rivals in many areas, and there's a concern that maybe that rivalry could spill over in space. Let's find out a little bit more about that. That's the sort of topic that I'm most interested in at the moment. And it's great to have Dr. Christoph Beischel join me on the line. He is Associate Deputy Director for the London Institute of Space Policy and Law. He specialises in the Chinese space programme, and he joins me now on Microsoft Teams. Dr. Beischel, thank you for joining me, and I'm intrigued to see what you think about the growth of this space programme.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. To jump into the topic, yes, the Chinese space program can be certainly considered to be the second most advanced after the United States. And there is a form of competition between them. And I thank you for using the term competition and not space race, because I don't think there's a real race going on between the US and China. The US, as well as other Western countries, and of course the neighbors in Korea and Japan, look very closely on what the Chinese are doing. And what this maybe, I wouldn't consider, call it unnerving, but what is very interesting to see is how robust the Chinese space program is. There's very little, there are not many mistakes made.
Why are they investing so much money in this program? You know, why is it leading the headlines, for example? Is it just for nationalistic reasons, which is one of the reasons why we have such a good space program here in the UAE? Or is there a wider, I nearly said the word darker, but I'm really keen to not do this polarization situation. But is there a wider reason behind why the Chinese might be developing their space program?
If we talk about the whole space program, it can serve many, many objectives. Without going into detail, I think it's easiest to understand that a space program, especially the Chinese one, can serve socioeconomic advancement. It can serve national security. It can serve political purposes, including gathering international prestige, but also linking states to one through cooperation. And of course, it can also advance some domestic scientific and technological development. So there's very good reason for the Chinese to engage in all of that, as well as for the United Arab Emirates, for that matter.
I saw a ridiculous headline about 3 days ago, which suggested that the US was, quote, ready to fight in space if we have to, according to a senior military official. Do you think there's any chance of that sort of scenario coming to fore?
If we're talking about a satellite-to-satellite, fist-to-fist combat, more or less, I don't think this will necessarily happen very soon. But yes, there is it really depends on how you determine a fight. But yes, there is a lot of activity going on that is not publicly displayed. And we also don't get a lot of information here on the academic side, but apparently there's cyber attacks going on. There's the danger of ASAT tests against satellites. And there's, of course, if it comes to a conflict, satellite systems are a very nice target because they serve so many military support services like navigation and communication. So if it comes to a conflict, satellites might be targeted, but I don't see a real what you would consider a space warfare activity that you can that is alike to Star Wars.
Yeah, you can tell I was going down that very, very sort of media line there, asking about Star Wars. I mean, what's interesting, though, is you mentioned satellites there. Is there a sense that that is where the greatest competition is likely to arise, this sense of requiring space for your satellites so that you can operate a sort of almost like, well, Elon Musk has his web of satellites. Is there a sense that we're running out of space in space?
That's actually a very good point. We always say space is infinite, but space around Earth or the low Earth orbit is quite finite because we also want to have some distance between satellites to avoid crashes. If Elon Musk comes through with his crazy plan to put tens of thousands of satellites into low Earth orbit and the Chinese follow and others as well, it gets very crowded. And the big problem is if the satellites crash into each other, that we have a cascading effect of satellites and then later debris crashing into each other, and we have a debris cloud around Earth that doesn't allow us to leave anymore. We as humans are very good at destroying environments, and let's hope that we can manage not to do so with the space environment anytime soon.
Now, I know that both the US and China have got a lunar program, and both seem to have sort of reinvigorated their lunar programs recently, or invigorated them in the case of the Chinese. Do you think there's any possibility of these two countries attempting a sort of land grab on the moon, or am I getting all media again?
The Outer Space Treaty doesn't really allow for a land grab by states or by private actors, for that matter. So from a legal perspective, I don't think that that is possible. At the same time, what is more interesting is to put up your first stations there and try to use the local resources for some purposes that can be space exploration or other means. And of course, if you have set up something, it is likely to stay there for a while. So it's not necessarily a land grab by sovereignty. It's more of a land grab by practical activity.
As one of the sort of foremost experts on this in this field, a big overarching question now, but do you feel nervous about the way things are developing or excited?
As well. I'm excited about the prospects of doing more space exploration and using space to develop or to advance our socioeconomic development here on Earth and beyond. I'm a bit conscious about what we mentioned before about the issue of creating so much space debris by allowing for missions like mega constellations, thousands and thousands of satellites around Earth that impact everyone and only serve some commercial needs primarily. I'm also a bit concerned about escalations in space from a military perspective. At the same time, military people a lot of times keep a calm head, so at least those that I speak to. So I'm hopeful. Best at the same time, hope we don't see any problems arising soon.
I'm enjoying the pauses in between your words there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line, Dr. Christoph Beischel there, with a very interesting standpoint on the relationship between the US and China when it comes to space politics. Dr. Christoph Beischel's the Associate Deputy Director for the London Institute of Space Policy and Law, who specialises in the Chinese space program. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Agenda on Dubai 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
We are fast approaching a period of deadlines. There seems to be an awful lot of them just sort of cropping up. I think it's because we're coming close to 6 months through the year. Almost unbelievably, we're coming close to the 1st of June tomorrow, which means we're a month away from the 1st of July. And that means that we've got this unemployment insurance deadline fast approaching. Now, Jennifer Crichton has been looking into this closely, mainly because I think you're able to benefit from it, aren't you? Whereas I can't. So you've got more into it than I have.
That's right, because of course you're freelance.
Yes.
And so freelancers can't sign up. But we did have this strange period initially when this launched, when none of us were entirely clear on what we needed to do. Your husband hadn't done it. Lots of us in the office hadn't done it. And the few of us in the office who'd gotten organised and tried to do it, we're struggling.
Yes,
because there was a bit of a... couldn't quite work out why.
Yeah, there was a stoppage.
Yes.
A block in the system.
And so about a month ago, we had Dana Kansu from the Dubai Insurance Company come in to speak to us about why that was. And in actual fact, it transpired that because here at the radio station, we work for a semi-government organisation, it fell under a different sort of criteria to those who work in private sector companies onshore and people who work in free zones. So that has all now been very much clarified for everybody, and everybody should now be able to sign up, as Dana explained to us.
Free zones and semi-government or any kind of company that falls under private sector were already included in the scheme since January 1st. However, the way they can subscribe is different. So now for this specific section of employees who work in those companies, which are the semi-government or the free zones, they have to log into the portal and they will have to subscribe under a field called non-registered in Mohri, which means that their information are not available in the ministry's system, which took us some time in order to implement a different approach for them to be able to register. But this, again, doesn't mean that this is a new announcement. It's just an announcement that the subscription channel is now available for them.
So since we had that conversation, I have actually signed up, and there is a different window that you click if you work in a free zone or in a semi-government company, and you have to upload your ID card. So it's a slightly longer process. It takes about 5 minutes as opposed to one.
Yeah.
And but that's, it's easy.
And my husband was the one-minuter.
Yes.
I messaged him this morning saying you've got a month to go to sign up for it. If you don't sign up for it, they're going to fine you. We actually don't know what the fines are yet, but we have been warned that there will be punishments if you don't sign up. And yet he said he'd actually already done it. It only took him a minute. You just need to put in your Emirates ID and they figure it all out for you.
Yes.
But like I said, it's up to the employee to do it. It's not your employer. It literally does fall on each and every one of us to do it, right?
Yes, and it is mandatory. And of course, that makes sense, because if we're going to be paying out 3 months' salaries to people if they lose their job, the scheme only works if everybody's paying into it. But the payments are not high by any means.
Yeah, they're not bad, are they?
They're really not bad at all. Really not bad.
And so Dana Kansu, she also sort of explained how that process worked the last time we had her on as well.
Today, the unemployment insurance covers you as an Emirati or resident working in both the private sector and the federal government sector against any job loss other than disciplinary reason. You will be able to get a compensation, a cash compensation, monthly one, up to 3 months, depends on the category you fall under. And the category depends on your basic salary. So if your basic salary is 16,000 dirhams and below, you fall under category A. Say your monthly subscription fee will be equal to 5 dirhams. And you will be able to benefit from a compensation of 60%, and this is very important, 60% of the average basic salary for the last 6 months prior to the job loss, up to 10,000 dirhams since you fall under category A. And the same applies to category B in case your basic salary is above 16,000 and you can get up to 20,000 dirhams per month for up to 3 consecutive months as a claim.
And even though those payments are low, they've also taken into account the fact that ideally they do want people to pay for a year or 2 years up front, but that not everybody has that sort of money in their pocket, as Dana explained.
The vision of the scheme is to support everyone living in UAE. And this was the initiative that the ministry had in order to support all the employees in UAE. Again, there are a lot of people who get a low salary at the end of the day if they are not part of the management of the company. So we need to think about them at the end of the day. And this is why the premium is the subscription fee is too low. And as a premium, as an insurance premium, which usually it's a yearly premium, the yearly premium is 63 dirhams for category A and 126 dirhams for category B. However, in order to support the workers, and especially the blue-collar workers, we offered a lot of payment options. So this premium, you can pay it monthly, you can pay it quarterly, annually. It depends on your preference and, let me say, on the financial decision that you will be taking on a personal level.
Now, of course, the other thing that Dana clarified, which is interesting, is that you do actually have to have been signed up for a year before you can claim on this scheme. So the sooner you do it, the sooner you're covered, effectively. Once you have been covered for 12 months, you are then eligible to be able to claim. And you can actually claim a number of times during your career in the UAE. So each of us, as long as we are registered in the scheme, is entitled to claim for up to 4 job losses. So you can claim as much as a year's support throughout your time living and working here in the country once you have been signed up for that minimum time period.
Interestingly, Milani, who works in our control room, who looks at us through the glass and controls me and my timings, or tries to, has said that her husband's company actually did it for their employees and they paid as well, and he works in a free zone. So I'd be interested to know whether maybe your company has made that a benefit, an employee benefit as well. It'd be interesting to hear from you. If you want to do it yourself, if you want to do it right now, and you need to, like we said, it is a mandatory policy. You just need to go to the website, which is iloe.ae. I'm having a moment there. No, it is iloe.ae. I'm delighted to say I'm joined in the studio by Andrew Hosey, who is our latest recruit on the sports news this week.
Got a rotation this week, have we?
Well, we had Mo for Monday and Tuesday, yep. And now he's on holiday.
Is he?
Yeah, he's actually doing a staycation. I'm sure he won't mind me giving every single one of his secrets away on the radio. He's actually got his brother and his sister in town. They normally live abroad. And they're going en famille up to Sharjah to stay in the desert, in one of those lovely desert resorts.
Oh, fantastic.
En masse.
Lovely.
So if you want to stalk Mo, you now know how to do it.
And you can narrow down those various resorts in Sharjah. So
yeah,
there we go.
Narrow down the beachside resort and go and hang out with Mo and his family. So it's very... I'm not sure he wanted me to do that. I'm sorry. Let's talk about sport before I reveal anyone else's address.
That sounds like a plan. Shall we talk tennis?
Let's talk tennis, yes.
There is a lot of it about Russia's Daniil Medvedev believes Thiago Seyboth Wild will be ranked inside the top 30 by the end of the year. Now, this is after the world number 2 suffered a shock 5-set defeat to the Brazilian qualifier. This was in the first round of the French Open. Medvedev, who is a former Grand Slam champion, doesn't feel he actually played that badly.
Great for him to play like this today. I honestly hope he's going to play like this later on, because then if not, I'm going to be disappointed. I'm going to be like, why today? And why not in 2 days?
So the French Open going on, of course. Just wondering, Georgia, are you one of these tennis fans that watches Wimbledon for 2 weeks and then that's it for the rest of the year?
Precisely that.
Yes.
Yes. But you can narrow it down to I watch the tennis here. For two weeks.
Oh, that's a point. As
yeah,
well,
so
yes.
I have 2 weeks in of English watching and then 2 weeks of UAE watching, and that's it.
I'm kind of similar, yeah. So this Open has kind of passed me by. But there is a lot of good matches that have already cropped up. And we're only on Wednesday. An American, Coco Gauff, she managed to avoid a shock defeat to progress to the second round. She had to come from a set down to beat Rebecca Masarova of Spain. She says she tries not to let the setbacks, including last year's final defeat to Iga Świątek, weigh on her mind.
You have the choice to dwell on it or reset, and I chose to reset. To be honest, in any circumstances, I think you learn from your matches, and once you're done from learning from that match, there's no point of revisiting it.
Of course. Oh, sorry.
It does feel like we're almost at a pivot point in the world of tennis, because you have got that changing of the guard with Federer and Nadal leaving the sport, almost leaving the sport in the case of Nadal. And the new guard coming up. Finally, we've got fresh blood, and they're going to have a chance to win tournaments.
Indeed. Djokovic still there, of course. He's the last of the old guard. Rafael Nadal is not there. He tried his best to get there. His comeback on fitness didn't quite fit in with the timetable. But Carlos Alcaraz, now he is the world number one and a Spanish, and is hoping that Nadal fans will switch allegiance to him at this tournament. He continues his push for a second Grand Slam title against Japan's Tara Daniel in round two later. Nadal's missing Roland Garros. As I mentioned, he has yet to fully recover from injury ahead of what's likely to be his final season next year. He's hoping to carry on next year. Alcaraz says they're big shoes to fill.
I feel the love from the people. You know, I don't know if they are the Rafa Nadal fans or not, you know, but I felt the energy from the crowd. I felt the love, you know, and it was great to feel that.
Okay, let's turn our attention to football news.
Yes, we've got the Europa League final tonight, and Roma boss Jose Mourinho will be hoping to maintain his perfect record in European finals. They're taking on Sevilla. The Portuguese is hoping to win his second trophy since being sacked as Tottenham boss a week before the 2021 League Cup final. Mourinho says there's a reason he's been successful in Italy.
In Roma, they didn't sack me before the final in Tirana. And in Tottenham, they sacked me before the final at Wembley. Roma gave me the chance to win the final at Tirana.
Right, cricket news.
There's always a hint of sarcasm in there anything really Mourinho says, isn't there?
Brilliant.
So Ireland cricket coach Heinrich Mahlen admits their test against England, which is beginning at Lord's tomorrow, will be a real challenge for his players. Now, it's only the second time the two nations have played in this format, with the tourists focusing more on the white ball game. Mahlen says the transition won't be easy.
It is challenging when you think none of our lads have played a lot of domestic first-class cricket for a period of time. But, you know, it's also our duty to go out there and do our best for our country, and hopefully, you know, through some of the individual performances we've seen over the last couple of months in the red ball space, you know, our players can adapt.
Sticking to cricket, and England cricketer Stuart Broad says an entertaining Ashes series this summer could help secure the future of the test game. The five-game series against Australia kicks off in just a little over 2 weeks after they warm up with this match against Ireland. Broad says they have to show young players the traditional format of the sport is for them.
The winning is vitally important, but for us, the style of cricket we play, if we can get kids in the park wanting to play the style of cricket we're playing, ultimately that's more important than the result, because you can still inspire the next generation.
Right, yeah, my kids have got into cricket recently.
Really?
Yeah, around about, they're 10 and 8, and they've really got in the zone. I think it's because they get to hit things hard.
That's a good point. Is it the short format, obviously, I think, in the way things are going, like 10 overs per match?
I don't know. I'm embarrassed to admit, I don't know. I haven't sat through an entire match with my eyes off my phone yet.
So at the moment, it's just whacking things.
It's whacking things, throwing things, and occasionally catching.
What about, and some running, I guess, involved as
well? Bit of running. So yeah, it works very well, actually. And obviously, there's a huge cricket culture out here.
Yes.
Because, of course, you know, when you drive out and you see a big sandpit somewhere, you'll always at the weekend see people playing cricket. And the kids have picked up on that, I think, which is really lovely. So yeah, Andrew Hosey, a pleasure to have you in the studio again. Hotel California scenario.
Absolutely.
I think we'd probably have you in tomorrow as well, if you fancy
it. Okay, sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, you could do the traffic and you could set up the program. And if you could also do a couple of reports for us, that would be great.
Sounds right. Like a really good plan. Cheers, I'll do that.
I love that you had to say yes to that, because I did it on air. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.